Oh, sinners and choosers and lovers and dreamers and hypocrites and cynical folks and everyone who's hugged a Presbyterian today. Welcome to Choose Your Own Religion. My name is Joe. Thank you guys so much for tuning in this week. If you haven't heard this show before, it's me, a comedian out here in Los Angeles, interviewing mostly other comedians about whatever their religious path was, is, will be. And also every episode we didn't make up a religion because most of us are godless heathens. But every now and then I really like having people who not only practice a religion but also preach it. Those are the episodes I am most excited about and most nervous about. And this week I am very privileged to have Reverend Howard Dudley on the show. Howard is the pastor and head of staff at First Presbyterian Church Dunn, somebody I've known for 15 some years, going back to Massanutten Springs in Virginia, which was one of the first places I experienced a true utopia in the form of a four-day middle school youth conference I attended as a little sixth grader, and just seeing these older high school counselors basically preach and live and act the Presbyterian Church considers to be the Word of God, and what I think is still is pretty damn good. And I still look back on those great times, and I ended up being one of those high school leaders later on down the road, and then also attended the high school version of Massanutten, which is Montreat. This is a lot of deep East Coast Presbyterian stuff, and I only address that because this is a very Presbyterian episode. It's a very personal episode for me, because as a lot of you know, I grew up son of a Presbyterian minister, but somewhere in college, I stopped believing in God and stopped following on that traditional path. And I mean, I've gone all over, really all over the place since. And one of the joys of this podcast is trying to reconnect back to that church and to that village. And so it was a real pleasure to have Howard come and talk about Presbyterian stuff and help bridge the gap. Because I don't know who all listens to this. I know a decent amount of Presbyterians listen to this, but I don't know who all out there is listening at any given episode. If there are people out there listening who are in the Presbyterian Church, I still love you guys, even though sometimes it feels like this podcast is almost a statement of how not Presbyterian I am. I think, as we talk about in this episode, to some extent, these are labels that are useful to communicate, however unhelpful when remembering that we are all connected by things that are much greater than whatever the heck we are connected by. So thank you guys for listening. If you like this episode, you can find more on ChooseYourOwnReligion.com. You can subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher. If you're interested, I'm starting a new blog where I go to a different religious place each week. You can find that on the website. It's called This Week in Spiritual Narcissism, because that could have been the other name for this podcast. And if you want to email me about anything, just contact me to say hey. My email is joe@joequint.net. I love hearing from you guys, so please feel encouraged to use that. Cool. That's it. So please, I don't know what you're doing with your heart right now, but for God's sake, let the Reverend Howard Dudley into it.
Allow the soothing music and uplifting affirmations to center your heart and mind in an awareness of God's love.
Wake up, my dear sinners. Wake up from your deep rest. Won't you say your prayers? Know that you are blessed. I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best. And I hope that you choose your own religion.
So yeah, thank you so much for doing this. This is I was looking forward a lot to this.
Yeah. I'm excited I can do it too, man. I'm sorry it took us so long to make it happen.
Oh, nah. And I've always, you know, it's just one of those cool life things where, you know, this is one of the benefits of getting older is having somebody you've known for like 15, 16 years. Just interesting. Like, when I knew you, I was like, I think I was a middle schooler and you were like a high school. You were like somebody I looked up to as an enabler in Massanutten.
Well, I was an enabler with your sister.
Right.
Yeah, like Anna and I were enablers all 3 years together, I think. Yeah, I think it was all 3 years together. And, you know, we're in part of, you know, and you know how it is when you're an enabler, you I would hate the word maple.
I was about to say. I wish they hadn't chose that word.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. I suppose for your listeners, we should explain that it's a high school counselor is what it is
right.
at this camp, this conference.
It's like
right?
a summer, yeah, it's halfway between summer camp and, yeah, it's, but it's like for a long weekend for middle schoolers.
Right.
Yeah.
It's hard to describe to folks because I feel like when you say youth count or like a youth conference, right? I feel like when you say youth conference, the thing that comes to mind, if anybody has any experience with it, is like, you know, there's like this loud praise band up front, uh-huh. and then there's this chance for you're supposed to come down and accept Jesus into your heart mm-hmm. and turn your life over to Christ. And then there's speakers talking about how you should not like have sex before you're married. And like, I mean, it's like a lot of right. stuff like that. And that's not really Massanetta.
No,
it's,
no.
It's full Montreat. That's not exactly, it's, I mean, but it's still, in its own, and it is very right. It's a very religious, spiritual experience. It's just, it's hard, I think, it's hard to describe it to folks who haven't really seen it because it doesn't really fit a lot of your assumptions, you know?
Yeah, totally. Those are still, I mean, those have to be my favorite memories, both as a high school leader and as an attendee of both Massanetta and Montreat. Those have to be my favorite experiences. Looking back of just like, cause even people who are kind of already like, you know, you have like your jaded, like youth group people, like there's already yeah. high schoolers who are kind of over it, but
yeah.
even they could get into Montreat.
Yeah. 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 And Montreat's pretty magical in that way. I just did music at Montreat this past summer.
I was about to say, yeah, you've done that probably a couple times now, right?
No, that was the first time I'd done music at cool. Montreat. I've done Massanetta a few times. I'm doing Massanetta this summer.
Gotcha. Yeah.
I got to keynote Massanetta too, which was, so I've done that a bunch, but that was the first time I'd ever got to do Montreat. I'd done Montreat Middle School, but I'd never done the actual high school youth conference.
And what was your kind of like path towards like transit? I mean, from doing it in high school, was it just always sort of a thing where you were like, you were always like a natural sort of leader in your own youth group. And then you were like, yeah, I love Massanetta. I love going to that. I want to be a part of that. And just kind of naturally progressed to following the ministry path. Or were there like deliberate moments where you were like, no, this is definitely, I want to go this way versus going another way.
So what you're asking about, Joe, is what we refer to in the pastor world as your call story.
Right. Oh, right.
How did God call you to the ministry?
Hey.
That's the fancy language.
Wait, don't people interrogate you with that question a couple times over your career?
Like, yeah, well, what's so your call? When you are trying to become a pastor, you have to jump through all these hoops to, like, at least in the Presbyterian church, to make sure that you're not, you know, going to be embezzling a lot of money or doing something terrible.
Right.
So you get used to telling your call story over and over again, because that's one of the first questions that you get asked anytime you sit down before a committee. They're like, so tell us your call story. Tell us how God called you into the ministry. So, mm-hmm. or when you're like looking for a church, like looking for a call.
Oh, right. Right.
They ask you that a lot too. So, yeah, I mean, I probably got into Massanetta as much because the older girls in my youth group were really into Massanetta.
Yep.
And I wanted to impress them and be cool and be like them. So, I mean, I went as a middle schooler, and it was still kind of a new thing then and loved it. I grew up at Wake Forest Presbyterian, and the church I grew up at was very much a very fast growing church.
Yeah.
Because it was located just in the suburbs where it was growing real fast. And so I probably became a leader in my youth group just by virtue of being one of the few people that had been there since early on. Our youth group kind of grew around this kind of core of us that were in youth group together. And I don't know. I mean, so church for whatever reason became like a thing that I did in high school. And when I went to college, I got involved with the camp with PCM, the campus ministry mm-hmm. at my school. And that was a real important fun thing for me. I think like, and I got asked to come back and do some some youth stuff, youth leadership stuff, like Massanetta and that kind of thing. And that kind of kept me plugged in that way. I majored in religion and was not going to major in religion. I was going to major in like teaching, and took a New Testament class and fell in love with it. I fell in love with thinking critically about all these things, scripture and God and my faith and all that stuff. And so it just, you know, I ended up majoring religion and kind of enjoyed studying it and kind of decided I wanted to go to seminary. And had applied to seminary right out of college, got in to a number of places, and ended up deciding to be a youth director for a couple of years at a church. Did that. That was a really, really rewarding experience. I think that kind of solidified the fact that I really wanted to go into the ministry and not just study this stuff. I really enjoyed the community, the, you know, working with the people, and enjoyed the mission trips. So then went to seminary, and you know, that's kind of how I ended up there. I don't know if there was one particular moment for me, but I know that throughout my time growing up before going to seminary, people would often say, you know, I think you could be a pastor. And I'd always be like, yeah, okay, I guess so. Uh-huh. it never freaked me out. I mean, you're a PK. So like, I wonder if did people ever say that to you?
Oh yeah, for sure. All the time. But it was hard to distinguish like how much of that was earned based on anything that I was doing versus like, oh right, your dad, that's your dad's business.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Right. But like, you know, I never like, I would wonder like that like suggestion, oh, you should be a pastor. Like, I wonder if it, what your reaction would have been to it compared to mine just by virtue of being a PK, you know?
Yeah.
Because like, you knew more about what it meant like to be a pastor because your dad was one, you know?
Totally. Yeah. I think, well, both me and my sister have some rebellious qualities in us, that's not necessarily always a compliment either. Sometimes despite myself, I will, you know, it's a classic sort of teenage sort of like, just because your parents say to do something, you don't want to do that. And I think I sometimes took that so in. I'm like, no, because in my mind, I never really, there's like one year where I thought maybe I would be. In fact, I applied, when I applied to Davidson, they have like an aspiring pastor scholarship there. And I interviewed for that.
I went to seminary with a bunch of those.
Yeah. I interviewed for that and I didn't get it. And so maybe I think that was my final, like, yep, not gonna do that. But actually, I remember actually like, because I was on the fence when I applied for that, but then when I was waiting to hear back from that, my other choices, I remember in my heart feeling like, I don't want to be locked into having to go down that path. I really don't want that. So right. I was like relieved not to. So it's, but yeah, it's a real interesting. What's as a pastor now, what has changed your perception of both, you know, church and at what pastors do from when you were rising up through the ranks?
Oh my goodness. That's a really good question. I don't know that I've thought tremendously about that. I mean, I think it's interesting. I think that I was blessed to always have pastors that I was close to and that I had real authentic relationships with. You know, like there was never a sense of like artificialness at all with the pastors that I had growing up and that I knew in college. And so I don't know that my perception of it has changed a whole lot. I don't know that I realized how political the church can be. And I don't know that I understood the responsibility that you have as a pastor. I mean, I think I knew it was a really important thing, but the responsibility of standing up and having something that is worthwhile to say on behalf of the Lord Jesus Christ.
every week.
and then the responsibility of caring for people in their families, in their most intimate moments. I don't know that I had a sense of that weight. I mean, I think I knew that was part of the responsibility, but you don't, I don't know that I had a sense of how much of an honor and how much of a responsibility that is until I got into it.
Right. Yeah. There's like an intellectual understanding, maybe when you're outside of it, but. Yeah.
But I don't think like I had like a drastically different picture of the life of a pastor. You know, I think I might have thought that it was probably way different back then. But now that I've, I had such relationships with really good pastors that, that I kind of got a feel for it. You know.
Yeah, and I've never thought about that. Like, I mean, I've thought of often a lot about the parallels of like. Writing, you know, giving, doing like a 15-minute sermon or however long you go for, versus like a 5-minute stand-up set or how 10-minute stand-up set or something. That you know, I have time to perfect those jokes over the course of months and in some cases years, and I don't have the weight of having to tell anybody's story but my own. You know,
that's right, really right.
Like, oh, right, you know, only God is watching.
Right. Yeah, but like. You know, I was saying, I was just listening to the Bear Stevens episode because we're, you know, I know him really well.
Yeah.
You kind of go back from the same circles and, you know, he was talking about the difference between music where he gets to play his song over and over again that he wrote, but you like tell your jokes once and then you like can't tell them again because somebody might've heard it before. Right.
Yeah. Well, when I'm doing it for the same people, I certainly feel that pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing here. Like I come up with a really awesome like story or sermon illustration and I only get to use it once, you know, unless I get invited to go to some other church or something. So you can't, you know, once you've used it on your congregation, you can't use it again.
Well, so then Massanetta gets like the hits, right? The best of.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. You collect.
Yeah. And then that's
why the conferences are so awesome.
Don't see me in September, you know, late September or whatever.
Yeah, just don't come by my church.
Just slogging through it. I'm curious too, because like, you know, something that, and I don't think either one of us really wants to talk about specific American politics that much. I mean, especially because by the time I release this, who even knows what will have happened. That was something where, because my, you know, the church I grew up in, I think was pretty similar to the one that you are, you're currently the head of staff at, that's what we talked about. And like, there's a mix of both sides of the aisle, but they all want to be in the same community together. And so it's like, it's tough when you have this, I mean, do you feel that pressure to like, do you feel more, I mean, I know some people think that you should use the pulpit as essentially a bully pulpit, to like be kind of activist-ish. Do you kind of see it that way or more of like, because my dad always was like about trying to keep the community together and trying to keep those bridges like intact and not really as the role in his, he didn't see his role as the one being like telling people what to believe, much definitely not vote or anything like that.
Yeah. 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 No, I absolutely, absolutely feel that pressure. I think that the most anxious I have ever felt about a sermon was the one that I preached right after the election. Mm. And looking back on it, I have no idea why I felt so anxious because like, I didn't say anything controversial. You know? Like I said, we should love each other, you know, like, but like, I mean, so I've been wrestling with this a lot. I think that, one thing that I think about a lot is there are different kinds of churches. There are churches that are very activist minded. You know, the Presbyterian Church is a pretty diverse denomination. We've got some really, really liberal folks. We've got some pretty conservative folks. And like you said, a lot of times we got liberal and conservative folks all in the same church. There are churches that are real activist minded. And I think, you know, a church like that, you're going to get a sermon that specifically calls out policies and decisions and those kinds of things. I think there's a responsibility as a pastor to always preach the gospel, and the gospel is not always going to make everybody happy. But I do think there's also a responsibility to try to like preach the gospel in a way that people can hear it, and speak truth in the way that people can hear it. If I stood up in my church and said that this specific policy is wrong, it's bad for America, you know, this specific candidate is wrong and it's bad, he or she is bad for America, or what, like if I said anything like that, even though I have very, very strong feelings about that, mm-hmm. right, that I want to say really bad, if I did that, what would happen is half of my church would go, woohoo, yay, like,
yeah, right.
Go, pastor, that's awesome, you know? And then the other half would be like, I would just shut down and not hear a word that I said.
Yeah.
And so, but what I find is if I preach the gospel, like if I say, Jesus says we have to welcome the stranger in our land. If I say, you know, Jesus makes it very clear that we have to love our enemies and forgive one another, right? Mm-hmm. If I make it clear, and if I tell the story of like, here is this person that I encountered, right, who was in need and fits right into the mold of the Good Samaritan, of the man that was beaten on the side of the road that the Good Samaritan stopped to help. You know, I can relate to those very real things, and I think everybody can hear them. And yeah. Those things, if you're hearing them and if you're listening, have very important implications, I think, for policy, right? Like, and for politics. So, you know, I don't talk about politics much from the pulpit. I don't reference what's going on in the world that often. I don't make any endorsements of like Democrats or Republicans, even though I might really, really, really want to. And another thing is I stay out of all that stuff on Facebook too, because and that's really tempting. I really want to say stuff there.
Yeah.
But you know, I have to, what I do instead is I say, I stick to Jesus, right? And I say, this is what Jesus said in his time. Mm-hmm. And I have to trust, I just have to trust that like, God is going to help people hear that. And I think that when I think back to the sermons that impacted me the most, right? Like, the ones that impacted me the most were the ones that really convicted me about needing to forgive someone or needing to look at someone a little bit differently, or needing to be more thankful in my life for the things that I have and not be so consumer driven, right? And none of those things were about politics, but all of those things have deeply formed my politics.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Totally. So, yeah.
And there was this article that came out just a couple of days ago that did a survey of churchgoers, and it said only 8% of people that go to church regularly want to hear their pastor talk about politics.
Oh, that's refreshing. That's actually very refreshing.
Most people, like 92% of people that go to church say, no, I don't want my pastor to ever say anything about politics.
You're like, oh, good.
But sometimes you have to, I suppose. And so anyway, I guess that's my general philosophy. And yeah. I'll tell you that I don't always feel good about it, right? There are times where I feel like I'm biting my tongue.
Mm-hmm.
Want to be speaking up, but I have to remind myself, I'm like, I've got a job to do, and I've got to do that job.
And you got to keep the long-term kind of view in mind too. It's, you know,
you talk a lot about on your podcast, you talk a lot about the need for like-minded community.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking about that, 'cause I don't know that like-minded community is how I would necessarily describe the church. Like, there's definitely some like-mindedness there. Like, we all, like, at least in the churches I've been a part of, there's this unified thing. And like, oh, yeah, like, we look to Jesus for the meaning in our life, right? Mm-hmm. But you know, there's widespread different, like very, very different ways of thinking about what all that means within my church and within almost any church that I've ever served.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that's kind of an interesting, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. And I, you know, that's something that, I go back and forth, because I think the like-mindedness, if you sense that, that's what helps you sort of want to even join a community. If you don't have something like, you know, if you're not Presbyterian sort of like, you know, culturally and your whole family is, like, of course I'm going to go to a Presbyterian church. Where else would I go? But if you're like, you know, if you're like in church shopping, so to speak, and I'm kind of doing that this year, I'm going to a different, but I'm not just staying within Christianity. I'm just going all over the map. But, I think that's what's going to maybe draw you in initially, is like, oh, these people think like me. That's what's going to make me want to participate. But I couldn't agree with you more that we want disagreement. And that's something that Ed Bacon talks about a lot, too. We need, like, Reverend Ed Bacon, retired Episcopalian minister, used to be the rector at All Saints here in Pasadena. But he talks about how a community isn't strong if you can't disagree with each other lovingly. You know, if we don't want total... you know, homogeneity, like, because then it's like we're not getting to a real, I think, sense of truth without, if we don't have an ability to disagree and call each other out and sort of like, because nobody has all the right answers, nobody's complete point of view is completely correct, and so we need each other to help come up with something greater together.
Yeah, well, and so you know, you're asking about like the current political climate. One thing that I said not too long ago to my church, and I've said this a lot, is I think the thing that we don't do as a culture anymore, and I say anymore, I don't know if we ever did it. I'm not good enough of a student of history, but one thing we don't do right now for sure is discern.
Yeah.
Like that's a big, you know, pastor word.
I was going to use that earlier, actually, in this podcast.
Right, but discern is something really important.
Yeah,
and in the Presbyterian Church, you know, what makes us Presbyterian is the fact that we discern, right? Like the thing that sets us apart is not that we've got like radically different beliefs from the Episcopalians or the Methodists or even, you know, anybody. It's what sets us apart is our way of discerning, our way of making decisions. And what we fundamentally believe is that God has given every believer gifts and a perspective, and that there's not any one or two of us that are, or a handful of us that have more authority. And so what we do is we elect elders and we sit down at a table and I say, you know what, I think this, and you say, I think that, and I try to convince you and you try to convince me, and we listen to each other and we try to come up with a consensus. Mm-hmm. And then we say, this is where God is calling us to go. So like, that is not at all how we make decisions as a country anymore.
No.
Right? Like what we do now is, I yell the loudest, mm-hmm. you yell the loudest, and whoever can yell the loudest and get the most people who they already agree with them the angriest or the most fired up wins.
Right. Or in Washington, it's like who can be more Machiavellian than the other.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. And it's not at all about – let's sit down at the table. Like when was the last time you saw a political ad that tried to convince you that the position was true?
Right.
It doesn't exist. Instead, what they say is like, you should be angry.
Right? You already know what's true. So, yeah.
You know, yeah. And so, like, you're going to see a political ad, and it's either going to make you really mad because it's by a Republican and you're a Democrat, or it's going to make you really mad because it's by a Democrat and you're a Republican, or it's going to make you really happy because you're a Democrat and, you know, you're watching a Democrat's ad, or you're a Republican and you're watching a Republican's ad. There's no discernment anymore. There is no sitting down. And so what I tell the church is like, you know, the fundamental idea of the Presbyterian Church is that we are going against this, right? Like we expect that we are going to disagree and we're going to find a way to make it work. God is going to find a way to make it work through us.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you ask me why I'm Presbyterian instead of something else, that's why. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And because I believe in that. And I think, like, it's crazy that that's a radical idea, but it's a radical idea.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. And that was one of my questions, was like, what sets Presbys apart? So I'm glad you answered that. I was just talking with somebody, I want to say yesterday or something, about how, because I think this is what I remember, like, growing up, and again, maybe this was just because I was younger and I wasn't having adult political conversations, so I wasn't privy to, but, like, I feel like it used to be, right, we all, like, we as Americans have common values, we as Presbyterians or we as Christians all have common core values, we so that builds a whole huge level of trust, even with your fellow American, like, we have this sort of common thing, and then there was an agreement that it seemed like it was just implied that, like, right, conservatives may think, they have a completely different point of view than you, but they're not bad people. Or liberals, they're not bad people. They see the same problems and disagree on the methods of accomplishing the same goals. I don't even feel like people are, I feel like that's even a radical idea now. I feel like it's just so hostile that we forget. And that's why I love, I don't know, that's why I tend to not want to get political, even with comedy, even though it'd be like the easiest thing in the my Los Angeles comedian circle to sort of play into, you know, anti-conservative stuff all the time. But I think this is what I see the church's role, what I see pastor's role is, like, there's a, the reason we're here, the reason we're going to church, the reason, or that we're not going to church or whatever it is that we as humans, there's a greater bond with us. And that is our divine connection, our connection to, you know, the things that are greater than culture itself.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And so to get so it dives into tribalism to focus on that stuff to a malicious level. I just can't. I don't know. I get very uncomfortable doing it, even though it probably hurts me with a lot of people who, like, might be like, well, why aren't you, like, saying, you know, this, that, or the other? But
Totally. I'm with that, with you on that. And it's so hard. Yeah. It's so hard. And I don't know. You have to cut through that tribalism, you know? And
yeah.
That really is the biggest challenge, I think, in ministry for me in these days, and for churches, I think, in general these days. It's an ongoing struggle. Yeah, for sure.
I'm curious to pivot the conversation a little bit. When you go out, you know, you're not at the church 24/7 your entire life, and you're not even around Presbyterians your entire waking life. You know, you're out and about like a regular, you know, person living life. Yeah. What kind of reaction do you get from non-Christians or non-Presbyterians when you say you're a pastor?
I get a bunch of different responses. Yeah, that's a common experience. I was just at a wedding. My sister-in-law got married, and we were up in Northern Virginia for that wedding. And it was this beautiful wedding. It was a fun time, and I did the wedding. I was the officiant, and then you know, it comes time for the reception, and everybody's having a good time, and it's a great party. And at the end, it was on New Year's Eve, so it was awesome.
Oh, wow.
We had the countdown and all that stuff. The end, like, I had like three or four people who'd been around me the whole weekend, like they're part of the wedding party or whatever, who, like, they came was like, man, what, you know, man, like, I'm not really religious, but, like, that was beautiful. And, like, I'd come to your church, man. Like, just really hammered. I was like, all right, that's cool. You know, and I don't know. I get frustrated. I think it's hard sometimes for non-religious people to be authentic around me. And, that's bothersome, you know, like I had this guy who was like, yeah, maybe we can, at the same wedding, he was like, maybe we can get together and we could take, you know, our brother-in-law out, somewhere, and we can, I was like going, I forget what he was talking about doing, but maybe like going hunting or something like that. And I was like, yeah, that'd be fun. He's like, we can just get together, you know, and we could talk about the Bible and go hunting. And I was like, or we could just go hunting. Like, we don't have to, you know, like right. I don't have to like be in pastor mode, you know, like
yeah.
you're an attorney. Like we don't have to talk about the law,
right.
You know, like, right. all the time or whatever. So yeah, I mean, you definitely get there's a level of that I feel of like it's hard for some people to be authentic, and I resent that. Like I mean, I don't resent them for that, but I like that's bothersome. And so like there are times where if I can avoid if I'm around a new crowd of people, if I can avoid mentioning that I'm a pastor, then I will. And it's not because like I'm ashamed of it. I'm happy to do it. It's just like, I also know that if I say that, it's going to steer the conversation
mm-hmm.
towards religion.
Mm-hmm.
And like, maybe that's not what we need to talk about at that point. You
right.
know?
Well, and for me, I mean, I do the same thing with like, I don't tell 99% of people I don't tell I'm a comedian like out in the world because like
yeah
and well some of those reasons are more just like personal annoyance where I'm like I don't want to have to like you know somebody's gonna be like oh tell me a joke I'm like it doesn't work like that I don't just tell you
yeah.
like you know or like but I think what it's like the same thing I've never thought about in that way but what I'm hearing from you is like there's this like separation that sort of happens like it's a sort of like I mean it happens anytime we like as human beings, as soon as we label stuff to help us communicate and navigate the world, but then that just adds a layer of of separateness from us as just two human beings, you know. And like we forget that like those are just roles, those are just hats that we wear to some extent, you know. They're like
I hate the like what do you do for a living question.
Uh-huh.
It's the worst question ever when you're having out a conversation, right? Like what you're doing when you ask that question is like you're trying to find something to talk about with that person because they're new to your life and, mm-hmm. and this is a new relationship. And so you say, what do you do for a living? And then you figure that that's like something you might stumble upon, something you can talk about. Like, okay, you tell me that like you work for this particular company and then I'm going to say, oh, here's what I know about that company. Right.
Yeah.
Hey, I mean, that's like the most inauthentic, like tell me what you enjoy doing, you know?
Yeah.
Or something else, you know, your family or I don't like, let's, you know what I mean?
Totally. And I love hearing authenticity come up with you over and over. Cause I think that's something that probably puts the finger on like why I've always felt comfortable just talking to you as I have felt that I could have an authentic conversation with you. And that there's do you think I'm just curious, like, what are non-Christians, do you think, is that one of their biggest misconceptions they have, not just about pastors, but just about Christians in general? It's like there's a lack of authenticity there? Because, I don't know.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, I bet a lot of it is judgment. And it's probably judgment that either they have felt in their lives. And there's also, there's a stereotype, right, that Christians are supposed to be judgmental,
right,
which is like, couldn't be further from what Jesus said we were supposed to be.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that like there are plenty of Christians that certainly are judgmental. Like, Lord knows I've been judged by plenty of Christians before. I am married to a pastor and she's awesome. And just the fact that she's a she would like mean that I'm going to hell in a lot of people, right?
Right.
Like, so I mean, that judgment's real, you know. I mean, and unfortunate. I think that's probably part of it. You know, people are afraid to reveal who they are because they feel like they're going to be judged by someone. You know. You know, and so I think that's part of it. I don't know.
Yeah. I didn't mean to like try to like, as a weird question to be like, oh, here's an obvious kind of was loaded, but
but I mean, I think it's a really good question.
Yeah.
And I think it matters, you know. I mean, I really do.
There's something I haven't thought about, so I don't know what the answer is I don't know what a lot of answers are in general, but I definitely don't know the answer to this one. Why is it that Presbyterian, and I, by the way, I love this aspect of Presbyterians that they're not evangelical by nature. They sure. don't call themselves that. They don't have, you know, any kind of outward facing sort of posture the church has tends to be towards mission and, like, you know, contributing to society versus trying to market or win people over.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, what do you, yeah, what kind of like, why, what's going on there? Like, why do you think that's not part of it or it
well,
should, yeah.
So I would actually say that it is part of it. I mean, I think that the word evangelical needs to be like reclaimed, to mean something much different from what it has come to mean. But you know, I don't identify myself as an evangelical Christian. I identify myself firmly as a Christian. I don't know that there's another label other than a Presbyterian Christian that I'd really put on myself. But there are definitely evangelical Presbyterians too. You know,
yeah.
I'll say that too. I should clarify that too. But I think to get at your question, you know, I don't like when I think about evangelism. Right. When I think about reaching out to people, for me, I believe that there's truth but I don't like believe that I have got that one truth and nobody else does. Right. I think that there's truth, and I think that I'm a Christian because this seems to be the closest and most accurate and authentic expression of the truth that I have come across. And it has brought great joy into my life, and it has brought great, it's brought great transformation in the lives of people that I've seen. And so I want to share that with other people. So that's, I guess just kind of understanding of what it means to spread the message, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you come and you find that this isn't for you, then I'm humble enough to say, well, maybe, you know, but I'm comfortable enough in my own faith to still be like, I think that this, I'm pretty sure and certain in all this and comfortable in all of this, but like not so certain that like I can condemn anyone else.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Totally. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so, I think a key piece of that is that fear is not a motivator. If I was going to separate like what makes Presbyterians particularly susceptible to kind of thinking about that in a different way, fundamental to like our theology as Presbyterians is the idea that like when you are claimed by God, when you are quote unquote saved, if you're going to use that word, if you are a person, you know, God's redemption is something that's just given to us like freely on God's behalf. It's unconditional. So, you know, I didn't do anything to earn it. Anybody didn't do anything to earn it. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing you can do to lose it. So
including, not doing the right communion, baptism, right. Stuff like
right.
that.
So, what if that's the case, right? If salvation is something that we are just given and that we don't earn, then that means that that the motivation you have, right, to go out into the world and be the best person you can be and serve God and love people and love your neighbor and spread God's word, the motivation that you have to do that is gratitude.
Mm.
It's not fear because mm-hmm. there's nothing to fear. You've already been given it, right? It's not reward because there's nothing to earn. It is gratitude. And so so everything that we do in terms of going out into the world and trying to like serve in mission or installing clean water systems or just inviting people to come to church or whatever we're doing, it's because we're grateful for God's love for us and the impact it's made in our lives.
Yeah.
It's not because we're afraid.
No, it's because you're like, no, this will make you happier. It's not about like what you should like. It's just it's a good idea.
Well, so then and we're grateful, right? I mean, that's the here's the other key thing about that, right? I think the only way you can really, if we believe that Jesus was really selfless, and that Jesus is supposed to be our model, I think the only way that you can actually be selfless is through gratitude. Because if you are serving out of fear, then it's ultimately your own concern that you're serving out of. And if you're serving out of reward, it's because there's something in it for you. And we're not serving because there's something in it for us. It's because of what God has already given us.
Yeah.
So all that to say, like, I think gratitude is necessary if you're ever going to be a selfless person. And that's a big theme in, you know, Reformed theology and in Presbyterian theology. And I think that's why that's probably why we express it the way we do, and kind of live that out the way we do.
Yeah, that's cool. You know, and as somebody, I haven't been a Christian for a while, but I didn't practice gratitude for a long, long time when I wasn't in the church. But then that's something in the past, really, I would say year and a half-ish, that and that what made me start thinking of it was Anne Lamott's book. Are you familiar with Anne Lamott? Yeah,
absolutely.
Probably. Yeah. She's like one of the big ones. But her book on prayer, Help Thanks Wow. Just as a simple guidebook to like styles of prayer, and just how much it's made it colors it. I mean, I do this every day now, and it's not the exact same prayer every time, but just improvised like things I'm thankful for, and including the bad stuff, that the quote unquote bad stuff that may have happened to me, the adversity I'm going through. And it really changes how I look at my entire day, and it just wakes me up like, right. It's not a given that Los Angeles exists. It's not a given that my health. I have, you know, all these amazing, it sounds trite when you hear it so much, like, oh, I have so much to be thankful for. You kind of like, you can say that in a robotic way, but true. We really do have a lot to be thankful for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so when you come to worship, right, in the Presbyterian church, everything we're doing is either saying we are sorry and humbling ourselves, or it is saying we are thankful and we're giving praise. Whole service is that way.
That's the special flavor of Presbyterian guilt. It's not that like we're like, you know, going to hell or anything. It's that, man, we could be better. We could do better.
We're terrible. And thank God that, we're in the hands of a God that's not right. Yeah.
It's God's not mad. He's just disappointed. That type of thing. Another thing I meant to ask you earlier, what are some of the key differences you find, being a head of staff in your current church and your current situation versus like, being the university kind of,
because I did campus ministry.
Campus ministry, right? Yeah.
Before, yes. I mean, I could talk about that for a long time. I mean, the thing about campus ministry. I mean, I was involved in starting two different campus ministries. So it wasn't just that I was doing campus ministry. It was I kind of was starting one from scratch. It was kind of an entrepreneurial, like, very much like starting a business in some ways. I did that twice. I did that in Richmond, and then I did it in Mississippi. And so this is different. I mean, I've kind of stepped back into a more kind of traditional established church. And
you're the man now.
Well, I don't, I mean,
the establishment.
Yeah. I mean, I'm the head of staff, and I preach every Sunday and all of that. But I think, like, you know, it's also like being a pastor is more than the preacher and the pastoral care piece. I mean, you really have to be the CEO of a small nonprofit in some ways too.
Yeah.
And, So, like, this is crazy weird skill set that I don't know that anybody actually has all of them. And so everything's always a growing edge.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, there's definitely growing edges that I'm tested on in this new call quite a bit. And but it's been good. And I've got loving, great people around me. And this church is fantastic. I could not ask for a more loving and welcoming community. And I'm very proud to be here and be their pastor. And I miss campus ministry. I miss my students a lot. And I miss the great flexibility that I had. I mean, I think a big difference here is I'm building on good things that other people have done over the course of 120 some years, which is how old my church is.
Yeah.
Like, with my campus ministry, we were kind of starting everything from scratch, and it was just a big blank whiteboard, and we could make it what it needed to be.
You're not following in the footsteps of anybody at the campus ministry. You're like, you know, you were the originator. They have to follow in your footsteps.
Right. Yeah.
You're the guy on the wall with the painting, the mural.
I hope not. I don't want to be the guy on the wall. But yeah, I mean, so the difference is a level of. There's a level of creativity, but I've been surprised at how much creativity I've had in this new call as well.
That's awesome.
And so it's been good. It's been good. Yeah.
One other question. I'm sorry, I'm kind of going back and forth a little bit between these types of modes. But do you think, and this may be an impossible question to answer. I'll just preface
all right,
it
let's
by
go
saying
for
that.
It. I'm do all about impossible questions.
Do you think that the version of God and how you perceive God is, how different do you think that is from how, let's say, other Christians view God and other religions view the divine?
Yeah. I could talk about this for hours, man.
Yeah.
This is a great question.
Oh, good. I was worried. I'm like, I'm not trying to be like, gotcha or whatever.
Yeah. This is like my theology. Like, this is the kind of stuff that I like read. That's what, like, all these books, like, I mean, I read like all this crazy theology stuff, and I always read it and I go, man, that blew my mind. Like, why can't we talk about that from the pulpit? You know, which you can,
yeah,
but it's just,
yeah.
it's hard stuff. So, I think that probably most people who are Christians, when they think of God, haven't put nearly the amount of thought into it that I have. I think a lot of them probably have. I mean, I'm not saying that people don't wrestle with that, but I think, you know, like a lot of people that are going to hear my sermon on Sunday probably haven't, they don't spend as much time thinking about it as I do.
I mean, you're paid to.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I read something by a Catholic theologian. I'm trying to remember his name, but it was really, it really has always struck with me. He talked about the word God,
mm-hmm.
and he said, you know, the word God is a God is a word that is borrowed from pagan origins. And so is the Greek version of the word God and the Latin version of the word God. That is fine, except that you can never make the mistake of thinking that God is God.
Yes. Yes.
And so, like, what he's saying, and the key thing there is the God with a capital G and then the little G.
Right.
Right. And I think what he's saying there is, so even if we know that this isn't the case, we have a way of just kind of reducing God to the man in the clouds with the lightning bolts who's like pulling the strings and is like doing magical things. And if you pray the right way, then you're going to get like that thing that you asked for. You know, like we were Christian theology, like the New Testament absolutely does not present God in that way. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like in Acts, Paul says that God is the one in whom we live and move and have our being. You know, John talks about God as the word that was made before he says the word that was made flesh. He says the word that through which all things came into being and without which nothing came into being. You know, they're talking about something a lot more, a lot harder to define, a lot harder to put your finger on, and hard to put in the language. I like what Paul Tillich says when he says that God is the ground of being. I'm reading this book by Marilyn Robinson. Are you familiar with Marilyn Robinson?
I'm not. No.
she's this author. She was like, she's this author. She's written a bunch of novels, and she's just wrote this collection of essays called The Givenness of Things. And I love that phrase in terms of talking about God, right? Because when I think about God, I think about probably the most amazing thing, fact of like existence, is that nothing exists because it chose to exist, right? Like,
yeah,
existence is given.
Yeah,
right? It's something that we are given. And so whether or not you can identify or say anything with certainty about the giver that gives existence, yeah, right? Maybe it's all just chaos. I don't know. But the fact that just the simple fact that it's given, right, is amazing. And that is what the word God has always tried to get at.
Yeah.
Now I believe I'm a Christian, so I believe I can say some things about the giver, right? Like I believe that the giver is love, and that love gets the last word, and it endures forever, and that's all embodied in Jesus, who came and died on the cross because we're terrible and we killed him, only to come back 3 days later and say, still love you anyway. I think there, and all those are things that are faith claims, right? But like, you know, I think we reduce God to, we make the mistake of reducing God to a God, right? A lowercase g.
Mm-hmm.
I think another thing we do is we reduce God into being, scientific hypothesis, right? Like,
right.
How did the world come to be? Well, there's this uncreated creator who was the first mover, and it's an explanation. And I don't think that doesn't work for me either. But it absolutely makes sense to me that it is a blessing that we've all been given the opportunity to be, and that the tree has been given an opportunity to be, and all of these things have been given an opportunity to be. And that is an absolute blessing that, with which I fall to the ground in humility and gratitude.
And I think
those two things, right, the humility and the gratitude, I think that that is something that most Christians get, right, about God. I think most people who talk about God get that, right? They get that they didn't create themselves, right? And the world didn't create itself. So, you know, even if in their head they've got a picture of an old man with a long beard and some lightning bolts.
Yeah.
And so, I do think that there's some difference there, but I think that comes from misreading the New Testament. Because New Testament's really clear about the fact that God is the one in whom we live and move and have our being, right?
Yeah.
And so I don't know.
And thousands of years of theology that have sort of culturally ingrained those images of God. That's something that Alan Watts, who's a, I don't know if you're familiar with Alan Watts. He was a British scholar, then turned sort of pseudo philosopher. He studied a lot of Eastern religions, and then he moved to California, sort of became like part of the hippie movement a little bit. I love his lectures on Eastern religions. But he talks a lot about, and he used to be an Episcopalian priest earlier in his life. But he talks about how basically like the image of God as a guy in the sky, which a lot of people has. We laugh at it, but it's also, that is a form of idolatry, you know, in a way to, but it's a really tough one for us to escape because it's so common. I mean, we see it from like, you know, cartoon, even people like kind of joking and poking fun at it. It just reinforces this idea that like, oh, that right. That's what we all believe, but it's not the case. And I love that, that idea that we are every aspect of existence is a given and blessing. It just makes me think of that song, How Can I Keep From Singing, you know, and that, you know, right. how can I not want to just be here and be present and enjoy it? And that's, I don't know, that's how I tied in with some of my own Eastern sort of leanings. And then too, something that I've also thought about with a lot of this stuff is that, like, you know, as somebody, I'm all about science. I'm all into the scientific method and all that. And I know a lot of Presbyterians are. Most, I would say, vast majority are.
Yeah.
But like, you know, in terms of like evolution and like, you know, evolution being the thing that explains the how, the mechanism, like physics being the how, but what I still have never had, I don't think science is able to explain, is the why. And yeah. I mean the why is in like, why does a plant want to grow? Why do I feel good when I am making positive growth in life, when I'm doing, you know, when I'm feeling forward movement, whatever that means? Like, why does that even matter? Like, why is that making a difference? Why is that driving
right.
life? Why
right.
do I want to, like, you know, what is that? What is underneath that?
Yeah.
It's love. I really do think it's love.
Yeah. And I don't, and like, I should, that's one of the interesting things about that, right? Is like, I say, you say, we say love, but like, I can't prove that.
Right. Right.
Right. And I guess like what like the atheist apologists would say is like, you know, the Dawkins types folks, like, well, why do we even need an answer to that question? Like, it doesn't matter. Everything we get is, I do need an answer to that question. I need something because I don't know that I think we've got to claim some kind of purpose and some kind of meaning in our lives and some kind of sense of right and wrong and value. And all of that comes from the why question. Mm-hmm. And the only way you can really do that is through some kind of faith, right?
Yeah,
that's Kierkegaard, right?
You gotta take
some kind of leap of faith. And I think it's important to say that faith is not, it's not ignoring evidence or disregarding evidence. Like, that's the problem with creationism, right? Right. These people say, well, my faith tells me this, so science is wrong. Well,
yeah,
you know, Augustine talked about needing our faith should be a faith that seeks understanding. And so a faith that seeks understanding isn't a blind faith, right? It's informed by what we can see and what we can know and what we can observe. And so, you know, I like everything I've ever read about, you know, evolution seems true to me, and scientists, I trust that they know more about it than I do. But right, they can't answer the why question, right? And
yeah.
So if we're going to answer the why question, then there's got to be some kind of step of or leap of faith or trust or something that gets us there, even if we don't, even if we're not so sure about what it is, you know?
Yeah.
And if we're still taking that leap of faith. Do you ever listen to, or do you know David Foster Wallace? Do you know who that is?
I know who he is. I've not really read much of his work, but, I definitely know of him. He's from out here, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, he was an author, and he was kind of like this quintessential postmodern author, and wrote some stuff and you know, did some stuff, ended up committing suicide probably about 10 years ago, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Really tragically, he suffered with depression, struggled with depression his whole life, but was an agnostic guy from all accounts, was not a religious guy necessarily, but he has this talk called This Is Water.
Yeah. I think I have read that one. Yeah.
Yeah. It's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all about how you go about living a purposeful life. And in it, he's got this section I think it stirs up controversy on the internet, but he has a section where he says, there's no such thing as atheism. That's the part that gets a lot of people mad, because you're like, don't tell me there's no such thing as atheism, because I'm actually an atheist. But then he goes on to say, what I mean is, there's no such thing as not worshiping. Mm-hmm. You will always worship something. And the only choice you get is, what is it you're going to worship? And he's like, so if you worship money and things, if that's where you get meaning in life, then you're never going to be rich enough. And if you worship intellect, then you're never going to be smart enough. If you worship beauty, and being attractive, you're never going to be pretty enough. And he's like, this is like the oldest truth that we all know, right? We all choose something to define our lives by, and whatever we're doing, I think I would say that's faith. You know, you're placing your faith in that this is what's going to lead me.
It's like, you know, the Bob Dylan song, You're Gonna Serve Somebody? It's like,
right. Yeah, same idea.
Same
yeah,
idea.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I, you know, and I listen to a decent amount of Sam Harris, one of the atheist kind of four horsemen of the atheist apocalypse, as they say. And I do enjoy his work because he's extremely logical. Sometimes, I mean, he's extremely logical, but there's the missing element to him is this reason I can't ever really go full, be full in the atheist camp per se, is that missing element is like, okay, we describe what is, what we can sort of like definitively prove, but then there's just an element of mystery, and there's just an extra sauce, and that whatever that's driving, like the things that, and those are the things that I feel like make us human, like emotion, things like purpose or whatever that, the je ne sais quoi of living. Yeah. And so while I don't, you know, personally, you know, fall in the Christian camp either, that's why I continue to be drawn to religious ideas and thoughts and I hate this phrase too, but I guess that's why you call me a seeker of sorts.
There you go.
I hate that just came out of my mouth, but what are you gonna do? I guess we're about out of time, Howard. I don't know if you need to ask me anything, or if you wanted to. I don't know if you had anything to like plug.
I don't get to make up my own religion.
No. I feel like it would be blasphemous.
This is going to be, I mean, you know, I think my religion will have one God and three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Uh-huh. You just pull out the whole Presbyterian
just
handbook.
Pull out the catechism. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I would just want to say, like, you know, for you, I mean, I've talked to you about how much I've loved this podcast, and I think it's cool to watch you, kind of seek and figure this stuff out. And I think it's awesome. I mean, you know, do you have any reflections on your own former Presbyterianism that you would want to ask me about? You know,
I don't know. Maybe I'll think of that. Maybe it's down the road. We do another one of these potentially. Because I definitely could talk a lot about a lot of this stuff. I still part of the angst of me wanting to start this podcast and do it. And by the way, and thank you for saying that, by the way. And when you originally reached out to me, it meant a whole lot. So I really, really appreciate that. But yeah, there's the angst of that while I sort of, I'm not in the village anymore, so to speak, especially to put it in like Joseph Campbell type terms. There's still something about the village that I still love and absolutely respect and yearn to be more connected to. So I really appreciate you coming on today.
Yeah, man, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting you say that because, like, in my mind, I don't categorize. Like, I think of you as part of the village, man. I mean, and like, I know you don't like in I know the way that you mean that you're not part of the village, but like you know, I think of you as you belong in more than one place. You know what I mean? And, I mean, I think you get what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
There. I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, and maybe part of it is what I used to call the Montreat Massanutta cult.
Yes. Yes.
You know what I mean? Like once you're in the cult, you never leave the cult.
Right.
Like it doesn't matter.
Yeah. The mafia. Yeah.
Yeah. Mafia. Maybe that's a better term.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Well, you're part of my village too, for sure. Man.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, dude, this is an honor. I've loved doing this. This has been fantastic. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Great.
And look forward to hearing more, man.
Well, Howard Dudley, is it Reverend Doctor? What's your official
Absolutely
title?
Absolutely not Doctor. Absolutely not. No, it's just it's just Reverend, and you can just call me Howard.
Howard.
Now, the previous two pastors here both had doctorate degrees, and I do not. And so when I first got here, people kept on calling me Dr. Dudley. And I was like, not a doctor. It's not, you can just call me Howard, you know?
And, yeah. Well, Reverend Howard, thank you so much for coming on. This is great.
Yeah, man. This is awesome. I appreciate it. Dude, good to talk to you, man.
Good to talk to you, too. That's the show. Once again, thank you so much to the Reverend Howard Dudley, or just Howard. Again, if you like this show, chooseyourownreligion.com. Email me at joe@joequint.net. I love you guys so much. Jamaste.
What's a Creative Podcast Network?